Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Who's here?
Hi, Dave. It's Robin. Sorry,
Robin,
I was on mute.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Great. Well, bring us up to date. How are things going for you? Any wins or progress notes?
Things are going pretty well for me. I have an opportunity on my job for a promotion, so that's kind of pleasant to find out about.
Terrific. What would it be to?
It's a promotion to really the next higher grade. It takes on a few extra responsibilities, but it may allow me more time for coaching, actually. There's a component in it I think I can make the argument for. So I'm rather excited about that.
Well, terrific. Congratulations. That sounds great.
Yeah.
How soon would that happen where you might be able to expand coaching a bit?
Probably, I would say maybe June, July time frame.
Okay. Do you have an idea how you'll expand coaching and what you can do for the business of coaching?
I think with the agency where I am, I will get on their list. There's a listserv they have so that when anyone in the agency or really federal-wide wants to be coached around anything, regardless of their position, they can. I would be in the queue, and my bio would be up there, and people can kind of look and see what I'm about and what I offer. And so I can. That's one way of getting clients.
So that would be paid by the government, then?
Yes, it would.
Interesting.
Are you
able to practice outside the umbrella of your job privately?
Yes, I would be able to. Yes.
Okay. Great. Do you have a sense of how you might, you know, launch that aspect?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. But I will be heading in that direction, though.
Okay.
Especially
if
given
I can help in any way, let me know. I maintain a priority and my lowest fee for mentor coaching for people who I've trained, and that's something that I've done a number of times is help people get their businesses launched. So
great.
Let me know if I can be of help to you down the pike.
Thank you. That would be wonderful.
Super. Has Emily arrived?
Hi, I'm here.
Welcome. We'll get to your presentation in just a bit, but any wins or progress notes to bring us up to date?
Well, I've been busy working on writing my thing, so I haven't had much time to go over other things, although I did was going back to my notes on section 2 on transformation, and I seem to be missing an entire I don't even have that portion of the notes that when I submit the manual. Is there a way to get that?
Okay, I'm kind of lost. Notes, whose note? Your notes that you took or what?
No, the one when you sent me the manual. When I got the manual, so it's missing a section of the chapter of transformation.
Okay.
Does that not make
manual,
sense?
Are you talking about the curriculum or the
workbook? Yes, the curriculum. The curriculum.
What's, you mean an entire module is missing?
Yes.
What module that's, is missing? There's not one called transformation, so I'm a little lost there. About
uh-oh. Your, that's
can,
section
can you tell
two.
Me what pages? Send me an
okay.
email.
Okay, I'll do that.
What pages are missing?
Are missing? Okay, I'll do that.
And I'll get my fulfillment house to address that. But from
okay.
what page to what page do you need?
Okay.
And remember, each module begins the numbering system. Like module 2, page 11 is 2.11. So you know the module is first, and then the page number is second.
Right.
And I did that so I could add components or change a module or update a module without having to do the entire thing. Okay, super. Is Paolo here? Okay. Anything that either of you would like to talk about before Emily does her presentation? Any challenges with your clients, anything with the curriculum, anything at all to talk about?
I would like if you could explain a little bit more about the self-empathy.
Okay. Okay. And I simply use that term to have a way to talk about reflecting on your own experience, to develop empathy with yourself and attunement to what you think and feel and experience. It's the development of self-reflection, which is kind of a prerequisite to self-regulation, all the things that self come in front of. But to be aware of what you think and feel and experience and find a way to be attuned to that, because that gives you a good barometer of when you can register what you're getting from someone else. There's a whole phenomenon of emotional contagion. When you're with a client, you will be able to, with a sensitive barometer, be aware of what that client is experiencing, of feelings, issues that you can be attuned to and resonate with that client and help the client self-reflect and regulate. And it's the best prerequisite to being empathic with another is to be grounded and centered and to be aware of yourself, your feelings, your experiences, your state of mind. We're going to talk about that even more as we've talked about it in the past. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, so the you're like understand yourself and you're more empathetic with yourself and you can understand someone else before you help someone else. You can help yourself first. Yeah, okay.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and what we do with clients is to help them become more empathic, to develop more empathy for themselves, to be able to look at and reflect on themselves and be able to understand their experience and their own dynamics more. And that is as important for life coaching as it is coaching a CEO. There have been a couple of articles recently in Houston in the Harvard Business Journal and the Scientific American Mind that indicate that self-reflection, this capacity that we're talking about to develop empathy with oneself, self-reflection is the most important success tool for executives. And I would say for everyone.
Right.
Regulating state of mind is so fundamental. So this is exactly what we're talking about here. The same kind of thing you do in yoga, for example, to get someone to be attuned to their whole mind, body, spirit,
right,
their whole sense of well-being. Well, are you ready to begin and present your roadmap?
Sure. You just want me just to read it, like from my.
Absolutely.
Okay.
However you like to present it.
That's good, yeah. I'm just going to read it.
Okay.
If I talk too fast, just slow me down, okay? I tend to talk fast. I did mine on wellness and relationship with self story. So recognize authorship. My name is Emily. I am 40 years old. I was diagnosed with a life-threatening cancer last year, stage 3 ovarian cancer. This was not my first battle with cancer. At the age of 4, I was diagnosed with a rare form of childhood cancer called rhabdomyosarcoma. After my cancer diagnosis at the age of 4, my dad committed suicide a year later when I was 5 years old. I grew up with feelings of abandonment, guilt, and shame. I was bullied as a child for looking different from the other kids in school. I grew up feeling embarrassed of my body and never wanted anyone to see my scars, especially my boyfriends. I was embarrassed by my dysfunctional family. I watched my mom remarry 6 times. I watched her be abused by men. At the age of 14, I left my house. I lived with a family who showed me what real love was. I went off to college but fell back into the trap of feeling unworthy. I felt rejected by men over and over. I became angry at this. I don't know what was wrong with me and why they didn't want to date me. The answer usually was, it was your cancer. It scared them that I couldn't have kids or that I could get cancer again. I felt worthless and unlovable my entire life. When my dad killed himself, I blamed myself for getting cancer. I thought it caused his depression, which led to his suicide. I thought he didn't love me. I lost both my parents, really, after my dad died. My mom was never the same. She didn't tell me or show me the love that I needed and deserved. Right out of college, I ended up marrying a man who I didn't even really love. I was too scared to be alone, so I married the first person who seemed interested in me. I had a gut feeling that this was not the right person for me, but I didn't listen to my instincts. I lived in a very dysfunctional and abusive marriage for 15 years until one day I realized my marriage was killing me. I acknowledge that I need to take over my life and not let my emotions take control. I acknowledge that I have the choice to allow abuse in my life or allow negative thoughts about myself. I acknowledge that I did not cause my dad's death, and that I acknowledge that I want to be a more loving parent than my mom was to me. I acknowledge that my past feelings of abandonment and feeling unloved has made me a very insecure person who has struggled in life with always trying to please others. I just want to be loved, and sometimes it has gotten me in trouble. Own your story. I recognize that I have been repeating the same patterns that have been repeated in my family. I allowed my husband to treat me poorly. I allowed others' negative thoughts or words to become the truth. I allowed my ex-husband to control me and still control me, even though we have been separated for 18 months. I allow my ex-husband to put fear into my head. What I hate the most is that I allow my husband to control me mentally in such a way that I'm afraid to attend my children's own school because he worked there. I am so mad at myself for allowing myself to let this man take away my time that I will never get back from my kids. I allowed him to stop me from following my dreams and having a career, who I really am. I have felt powerless these past 15 years. I have felt like the victim of my own story. One day my husband said to me, "Nobody cares that you had cancer, and nobody cares that your dad committed suicide." After that, I have questioned who I am. My entire life, I have defined myself by cancer and my dad's death. I believed that nothing in life was worth living for. At that point, I became so depressed in my marriage. There was so much fighting and chaos in our marriage. 2 months before I was diagnosed with cancer, my husband kicked me out of my house and served me with divorce papers. I lived in so much fear that I couldn't leave my house sometimes. I was ashamed of myself for my marriage failing. Everything he told me about myself seemed true. I was nobody, and nobody was ever going to love me again. He said I was unlovable, and maybe I was. My aha moment was January 9th, 2015, when my oncologist told me I might die in 6 to 12 months. She said this ovarian cancer is a effing, bad word, monster. The surgery is going to be radical. It's go big or go home, she said. That saying stuck in my head, go big or go home. Everything from that moment on changed. I did not want my kids to feel guilt, shame, or unloved as they grew up. I had the opportunity to close one chapter of my book and write the next chapter. I recognized that in order to survive and heal myself, I had to let go of all the anger and resentment that I had been holding on to. It would only make me sicker. My goal was to survive, and if that meant forgiving my husband for all the horrible things he did to me, then that is what I needed to do. I knew I didn't want to live in fear anymore, and that I didn't want to feel anxious and angry all the time. But mostly, I had to forgive myself for all of the emotional pain I have caused myself. I have put so many negative thoughts in my head and have really created this story that as a little girl, nobody has ever loved me or wanted me. It's funny how when I was told that I was going to die was the exact moment that I started living for myself. I was the creator, and I still am the creator of my story. I started to transform last year after I saw that my kids were afraid of me. They didn't like seeing me cry. They didn't like me yelling. I was on chemotherapy, and some days I couldn't help it. I began to see my husband in me and my mom in me, and I didn't like that. I realized at that moment that I might have to change. I realized that I can't change my kid's father. I can only change myself. My kids don't like seeing me and their father fight. I couldn't control my anger towards him, and my kids could see this. I realized that in that moment when my kids were crying, please stop, Mommy, stop yelling at Daddy, that I needed to change too. The story would keep going on the same. The plot would never change if I didn't change. I wanted to change for my kids. I didn't want my kids to relive the pain and shame that I felt growing up. I knew this wasn't going to be easy while I also was trying to survive cancer. Everything around me was falling apart, my family, my health, and my friends. I somehow found the strength to continue to fight for my life and the future life I wanted to have. Nothing was going to stop me. I remember telling myself, if I am going to die, then I am going to show my kids what a fighter I was. I wasn't about to die in vain. I was going to prove to all those in my life who hurt me that I am somebody and I am worth living for. Assess plot and storylines. When looking back at my storyline and plot of my story, my entire life I have lived with or around chaos and abuse. I even participated in that abuse. There was a specific moment when the light bulb turned on in my head that I can control this chaos. I was having a conversation with my oncologist at one of my appointments when tears ran down my face and I told him, I feel like dying. I said to him, I am worthless and nobody loves me. Nobody will even care if I die. He stopped me and gave me this visual image that I will never forget. He said, your life is like a bounce house, you know, the ones kids use for birthday parties. Your life is chaos right now. He called it the perfect storm. He said to me, cancer is bad enough, and you have to deal with divorce at the same time. But you are amazing and strong. He believed in me. He reminded me that I had the fight inside of me to keep going and encouraged me to stop being too hard on myself. There was nothing that bad that could be worth dying for. That was the moment that I realized that I do not want chaos in my life anymore. Underneath all the pain was a woman who was still living in a four-year-old mind and body. What I realized was that I never grew up from that moment. I have been living in my past my entire life, and it was exhausting. I realized that I can change the story. I am the author and creator of what I want the plot and storyline to be. All that time, I have been letting others ghostwrite my story. Decide what to change. Once I realized that I didn't want chaos in my life anymore, I had to decide what to change. The most important thing for me was letting go of my anger, and the second thing was changing that negative voice in my head saying, you are not good enough. My anger has caused the most chaos between my children and their dad. There were no rules or boundaries in our family. In order to reclaim what I wanted, I would need to start setting boundaries, first with my ex and second with my kids. I was being controlled by my kids and by my ex. I was scared of my kids and my ex. I had to start letting go of the fear I had from feeling as a parent and as a wife. What needed to change was that I had to start loving myself and getting help for myself. Before I could show my kids what I wanted for our family, I would have to learn how to be a role model for them. I had to forgive myself for all my mistakes. I would have to forgive my kid's father for the pain he caused me. I know I need to change how I react to what others think of me. What others say about me is their opinion. I can't control what others think. I can only control myself and who I want to become. If I want to be loved, I must first love myself. I can't teach love to my kids if I don't know what love is. This was a breakthrough for me. I don't want my kids to feel unloved like I did. I never want my kids to feel worthless like I did. I know that I am a good mom despite the negative words my ex-husband would tell me. I would allow him to abuse me and say things like, you are a horrible mom. How does that make you feel that your own kids don't love you? I want to change the way I react to my ex when he says cruel things to me. I want to get to a point where I don't hear his negative words in my head anymore. I need help with how to control my emotions and not let my emotions control my day or mine. Map changes. After I started the New Life Story training and putting it to use for myself, I became more clear. I now understand that my story doesn't define me. I feel more balanced in my life. I know when my brain tells me I am a bad person, that is really just a thought that is triggered by my past. I visualize loving myself in a nurturing and positive way. I only let in positive people into my life now. I am working on controlling my emotions by seeing a therapist who specializes in post-traumatic stress disorder. I am taking parenting classes and learning how to set boundaries and new rules for my family. This is all new for me because I have never had rules and have always had a hard time saying no to people. I have a lawyer that I am working with so she can deal with the emotional and financial stress from my divorce. I will not allow that stress back into my life. Stress causes disease, and I do not want to get sick again. I have cut out all toxic people in my life. I am beginning to take time for myself without feeling guilty. This has always been a huge part of why I never followed my dreams. My ex would call me selfish for wanting to get more education or for taking time for myself to exercise. I now see that I need this time to become more creative, which results in less chaos in my life. I have created my own support group of other inspiring women who are cancer survivors. This group is my safe haven. I have written a journal over the past year through my journey with cancer and divorce. What I have discovered is that writing was helpful. What I discovered is that writing has helped me heal. I have decided to confront my fears and not let them stop me from living my life. Author new experiences. I have taken action. I have and still am authorizing new experiences. I have created a beautiful safe haven for my kids where I feel safe and happy. My house, my new house, is a little piece of heaven for me. I visualized a house that was bright and cheerful. I moved into a new house that makes me very happy. I am letting go of the old life, the old me, the insecure me. I am doing things that are so out of my comfort zone, and I am achieving goals that I have always dreamed of. Once I have opened my heart to love myself, I feel that many new doors and opportunities are opening for me. My business is improving. People want to be around happy people, and I am attracting that. By changing my relationship with myself, my career story is automatically moving in that same direction of growth. I see big changes in my future. I have met with a copywriter and ghostwriter who is helping me organize my life story that I have been working on this past year. I no longer feel worthless. Through therapy and life coaching sessions, I can see how creating your new life story is possible. I didn't understand that until I started this class, but now I see that every day I wake up, I can write my story. I get to be in control of what I want and don't want in my life. I have invested a lot of time into my self-healing through therapy and support systems. It's finally paying off. I feel loved by so many in my community, and I want to give back the love they gave me during my cancer battle. I am making new relationships with women, making new friends, and even have given a speech in front of 300 people for a children's cancer fundraiser. My students from this large crowd and conquered a fear of mine, public speaking. I believe that nobody cared about me or my story, and now I see this isn't true. There are thousands of people inspired by my story. I finally believe in myself. That is the biggest miracle of all. I no longer depend on other people to make me happy, and this has probably been the biggest and greatest experience of my life. I have learned that if I love myself, I have more love to give to my kids and those around me. Loving myself has helped me let go of anger and shame. This is my time to author as many new experiences that I have been holding back due to fear and insecurities. Program new experiences and identity. As I have programmed new experiences and have experienced a completely new identity after surviving cancer, I feel alive for the first time in my life. I wake up every day smiling and grateful to be alive. I have so much excitement that I finally have control over my life. Just in the past weeks, I have seen a huge shift in myself and in my kids. I have my kids writing journals and letters to me that I am putting together as a small book to help other kids that have watched their parents go through cancer. The most important experience I have gained from Roadmap and the work I have put into making changes is that I have seen my kids change because I have changed. This to me is priceless. I wasn't able to get my kids to go to therapy during my cancer battle and divorce, but I have just recently gotten them to journal their feelings. I can now see how scared they were. I was angry at my kids before for not sharing their feelings with me and not wanting to be around me while I was dying of cancer. I now see that they were so scared and afraid of me dying. It was too hard for them to see their mom in pain. After I let chaos out of my life and let go of my own insecurities, my relationship with myself has changed and my relationship with my kids has changed. I almost gave up on my kids, and Roadmap honestly saved my relationship with myself and my kids. Thank you, David. I have taken back my power. My nickname during this journey has become Empower. I am now rebranding my business and myself as Empower Living. I am so excited for this next chapter of my life. I have specific goals set so that I can take two books that I have been working on to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference in June, where I will meet with publishers. I also am in the process of starting a nonprofit organization called EmpowerLiving.org. I already have my first fundraising event set up with the Usborne Children's Books. They have a Literacy for Life program. My goal is to raise money, a lot of money, for kids that have cancer and buy children books for kids through this program. The money raised will go to the program, and they will donate 50% of a total amount raised. I will be able to donate books in my name to the Children's Hospital. This is important to me because as a child that had cancer at the age of 4, I never learned how to read until I was 8 years old. I developed a learning disability and struggled all of my life with reading. I have met a wonderful man who treats me well. There is no yelling or screaming in this relationship. This makes me happy. I have never known what it is like to be in a relationship where it's okay to be yourself. This is a new feeling for me, and right now I feel like I'm on top of the world. I thought I was going to die 6 months ago. Being diagnosed with cancer for the second time in my life has made me realize how precious and short life really is. Realizing that my life could be taken away from me in one instant was a huge wake-up call for me. Through this journey, I have learned to love myself. I can finally say that I am proud to call myself Empower. I will never let another man or person take away my power. My story of cancer is over. My story of abuse is over. I am the only one that can create my future story, and that future is bright and filled with loving light. The end. Long, sorry.
Wow, thank you very much. That's very powerful. Congratulations. And that's a story of self-empathy.
Exactly. But yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, let's open it up. Are there other thoughts or feedback or comments?
This is Robin. I am just so inspired and so moved by this. And I see some similarity that I guess runs through everyone's story in terms of letting go of fear and the changes in your identity and how you view yourself and who you are and who you want to be and your place in the world. And my story is very different, but I saw some parallels, and it just drew a lot of strength from from that journey. That's a heck of a long way to come in 6 months.
Thank you.
It is.
It's been a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And
you're welcome.
Since all the work that went into it, not just the story, but in the condensing it into a form like that. So thank you very much. Was it helpful for you to put it in the roadmap format?
Yeah, because I've been writing, journaling for the last year, and I know the story in my head, but when I wrote it down, and I was looking at the other roadmaps, and some of them were kind of confusing for me because their stories didn't relate to mine. So once I just started writing my story from beginning, middle, end, then I started using your roadmap, and it was more helpful that way.
Okay, great. Well, good. Good. Any other questions or comments about the presentation before we move on? Well, again, that was just terrific, and thank you so much for sharing it.
You're welcome.
To hear it.
Thanks for listening.
Well, we're going to talk about your new money story. What I'd like you to do is to write down three questions. And at some point, come back to the questions and really reflect on what your answers are to each of these as a way to a beginning of looking at your money story. Number one, what's your money story? Now, and by that I mean not your income, expenses, assets, debt, but your relationship with money. The plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Two, what is a healthy relationship with money in your view? And three, what would you ideally like your money story to be? Now, I want to begin in this way, for you just to listen to this and reflect on it. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. You engage it every day of your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You may get 10 years out of a car, maybe 50 with a spouse, but this story, you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you still orient life decisions around it. And you alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of your life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play, health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are impacted by this story. At times, you've used this story to regulate your moods, adjust your self-esteem, perhaps to influence others, or even to soothe emotional pains. The villain or hero of this story is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, and you speak with it. It's your money story. So, let's look at the question, what's your money story? And again, it's not your income, your bank account, your investment portfolio. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, and what you think money says. says about you. It's a running dialogue of how much you feel you deserve, how much you feel you're worth, even how much you feel you're capable of. And it's about what would happen if you had more or less. So let's consider some of the ways that we speak with money. We speak with money first in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. It can represent anything that you decide. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, yet what we fear and lack, or for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We use money to show how much we care, or at times how little. We use it to try to measure success and buy happiness. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also use money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it is. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains or even buy the respect of others. We use money as a self-statement. And money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements, and the story always tells most about the teller. Here are some of the statements that money can make. A proclamation of freedom. Assurance of love, embodiment of power, affirmation of autonomy, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, to foster alliances or exclusion, an instrument of control. And there are so many more. This is just the tip of the iceberg. For example, you see a new car and want it. What you're really doing is acting out your money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that may say one or some of these things. This car is going to show how much I'm worth. This is going to make some of my struggles easier. This may make people respect me. This is going to validate me. And the obvious example of self-statement is spending money. Conspicuous consumption. You buy a red convertible and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption, you buy a red convertible in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-spouse's house. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. Consider also that we use money in self-talk, the messages we tell ourselves. These internal beliefs, and these can be the shadow story of money. The surface story may be simply, you know, I'd like to make more money and generate wealth. But the shadow story can be what we're not quite aware of or not quite fully expressing. It can even go in the opposite direction of the surface story. Well, people who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money can really buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. Our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Some of the money issues are really about money, but many, in fact most, are about other matters, private or even secret, that hitchhike on money. We take money, the tool, way too seriously. We don't take our money stories seriously enough to recognize that we write them, live them, and can revise them. It's hard to get money just right. It can occupy too much of our lives or too little. Its importance can inhabit too large a space or too small. Consider the inner dialogue that we have. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. For example, we can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you may not see the next dinner party. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? You might not see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference that I attended discussed working with her authors over the years. This was an internationally well-known agent. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations, and she was well into the two-hour conference. And finally, someone in the audience said, would you talk about money before our conference is over? How much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? Because she had not talked about that. Well, she looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. And an older gentleman in the back row said, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. And the presenter revealed specific figures and went on to lead to a discussion that was immensely useful to her audience, most of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. That was exactly a century and 3 years ago, the year 1913, the therapist Sigmund Freud. Most of us have learned by now to talk more easily about sex, yet may remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories. The first book I did about money, I used this quote on the front flap. The book was called The Last Taboo. At that time, in 1986, there was only one other book about money and the meaning of money, especially in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. Yet it's something that we dealt with every day, and that every therapist and every analyst dealt with it on a daily basis. While we may speak openly or at times avoid openly speaking about something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. So what that means is we create internal and external conversations about money. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy, for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. Here are some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton for my dad on hot summer days. When school started, I saw my classmates enjoying sodas and candies. I immediately joined in. My treats were very quickly gone, and I instantly wondered, was that candy worth half a row of cotton? Will I get enough from another soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? And I immediately answered no to both questions. It's part of the consideration of the cost of money, not just the value and the spending of money, but what does money cost, the time, effort, energy? Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. Or the preamble to spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on a big screen HD TV, but if I spread it out over 9 years, it only costs 27 cents a day. Another, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money spent without debate. Salary money used after really serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias that we treat a dollar differently placed, depending on the frame we place around it, or the spender. And this was from someone who had had three bankruptcies and was on the verge of a fourth. The high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. Or the parent. I spend so much time at work when I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it. Spending money makes me feel like I'm providing for my family. Another consideration, how money speaks to us. Money sometimes speaks to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. It can speak to us as a confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, or drug. Money serves as a tangible container for any number of things, from hope and freedom to love or disappointment. It can become a currency of caring, a symbol of success, a measure of power, any number of possibilities. And we make money mistakes because we use money to accomplish non-financial goals. And think about it. In the very simplest way, money is simply a medium of exchange. Everything else is what we project onto it. And we seek to use money as the thing no thing can actually do, regulate moods, influence others, increase self-esteem. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains and buy the respect of others. In other words, we give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, make it bigger than it really is. The more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what it really means. And then we can do strange things with money. Some examples. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Two of my former clients were Madoff victims. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people can't convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise, balanced individuals can spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they become serious. Highly principled people can step over boundaries and write their own rules about money. And the messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to. So, let's ask simply, why is our money story so important? Well, a simple answer, it permeates everything we do. It ghostwrites every aspect of our lives. What we eat, drink, read, fear, plan, buy, all affected by our money story. Our health, our jobs, our families, our dreams, all impacted by our money story. Day by day and dollar by dollar, our money story becomes an integral part of our life story. It's also important for another reason. The money story we each live will be the one that we teach our children and our clients and our employees and colleagues. When we talk about money, our experiences and ideas regarding money, we're really talking about ourselves. A money story reveals our relationship to ourselves as well as to money. Now, let's look again at the power of story. This is a study, one of the original studies in this regard, in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI scans when they tasted five Cabernet Sauvignon. Each were identified up front by different prices. So the volunteers ended up, as you might expect, rating the wines according to their stated prices. The most expensive wine was everyone's favorite, and then on down to the cheapest wine was the least favorite, and the volunteers showed a corresponding increase in activity in their brains to correspond with their choices. The most expensive wine that they enjoy the most, they got more of a spike, more activation of their pleasure center. Now, the volunteers actually tasted one wine with five different stories. they experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. And here's a money quiz. In the workbook section of the curriculum, look at your answer to number three, the question, money means to me. If you haven't done that exercise, think about it right now. Think of the one word, the first word that comes to mind, money means to me. Think about how money can make any statement. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. Marketers know this. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink block of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when we are asked to imbue the design with meaning, the interpretations are as wishful and as varied as each person's fantasy. Now, let's look at money equations. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or even their morals. In fact, one woman said, I don't know why money's getting the best of me. I have good morals. I should have good money. Well, of course, money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Or even their ethics. President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know better. You may work hard, but overspend, gamble, have five kids who have three of them are in college, live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction, any number of possibilities. Here's a question just to think about. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? If you look at all cultures, races, occupations, nationalities, who has the broadest net possible? Who in America has the best work ethic? Anybody have a guess? Even a wild guess.
What race or what?
Any job, occupation, nationality, race, culture, ethnicity.
I say, I'm from Santa Barbara. We have a lot of Hispanic workers here that work in the fields, and they work their back off.
Okay. And I've had people from Houston guess the shrimp boat workers, or even farmers. Yeah.
Right.
Are you ready for the answer?
Yeah.
Heroin addicts.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, holidays, 365 days a year, they cannot let a single day go by without working. In fact, one heroin addict put it this way, tomorrow, if I don't get up at the crack of dawn and hustle all day long, the next day, it's not my self-esteem that suffers. The next day, I die.
Ah.
Now, the reason I mention that is to distinguish work ethic from performance ethic, or especially success ethic. I mean, how many times have you heard somebody say, well, you know, I was at my desk 8 hours or 10 hours today. But performance ethic is an evolution from work ethic, and success ethic even more so. So I mention that just to distinguish between the two. Now, I want to talk about debt story for just a minute. If money were about math, we wouldn't need to be talking. If money were about math, no one would have personal debt. But more than math, money's about emotions and psychology. It's about each individual money story. The average American family now has 6 credit cards and carry an unpaid average balance of more than $9,000. For these families, an attempt to pay off balances by making the minimum payment each month would take just shy of a century. So this debt story is a strange, addictive world of spending and debt. In fact, my very first client, somebody who had been waiting for me to began practice as a mentor coach, began working with me, and had a specialty in the financial arena. I can't say anything more because she's well known in this area. And it took us about 4 to 5 months of working together until she finally mentioned that she has a debt of over $500,000 that not even her husband knew, and she was having difficulty servicing just the interest on this debt. The feeling of shame was so great for having it, and especially being a financial professional in a related field. Money's become more abstract, like using credit cards, so our debt has soared. In fact, when someone uses a credit card, they spend on average 23% more than when they use cash or checks. Money's become increasingly more tangible. And here's a 22-second history of money. First, people traded 2 goats for 5 bags of rice. Then, coined actual metal for the first use of money. Then, paper bills that were tied to the actual value of metal. Then, paper bills that weren't tied. Then, plastic. Then, ultimately, electron configurations of digits. You know, so going from actual to paper to plastic to electron configurations has become more abstract. As money's become more abstracted, our understanding of our relationship with it fades. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our banker's hands or our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't. The components that work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life, to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money, in other words. Your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story. Here's an example that I think might be helpful in terms of your practice, an example of hitchhiking. There was a large study by the Wharton School of Business. They surveyed several thousand professionals. And this is what they found. If someone declines your professional services, even when they need them, which of the following do you think has the highest impact on their decision? And, interestingly, the same reason is the primary reason why people will accept your professional services when they recommend them. So, this is a quiz. What do you think it is? Your credentials, reputation, your experience, the amount of your fee, or the state of the economy? What's your guess?
I say the fee.
The amount of the fee, okay. Robin, what do you say?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
If a survey of several thousand professionals, if people either decline or accept your professional recommendation for services, the primary reason is the same for both declining or accepting. What do you think the primary impact reason is? Credentials, reputation, experience, amount of the fee, or state of the economy?
Amount of the fee.
Okay, so both of you agree. Well, the answer, none of the above. It's how you state your recommendations and your fee. Clarity and confidence. This is what the Wharton Business School found. The credibility of professionals is hurt if they're fuzzy about fee. It damages the trust that people have. And for most people, the issue isn't whether the fees are high or low, but that the professional is clear and confident about stating the recommendations and the fees. So, no matter how capable you are, clearly and confidently discuss your recommendations and your fees. Now, here's what I think is an explanation, subliminal language. This is a huge factor. The professional is confident in stating fees. First, we know from neuroscience that emotions and states of mind are contagious. Confident is a state of mind. I have a blog of that title that's archived in my blog series, if you're interested. Here's a study that I think demonstrates this, and it's interesting. Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was such a short time, they were unaware that the words were shown and couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice. In other words, it was subliminal conditioning. Yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would judge others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, they would walk more slowly. And they would do this for a period of time of 40 to 50 minutes after the word was flashed. And when these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked the way they did, there were two responses. First, well, they didn't know, but they always came up with some reason. Even though they didn't know, they always came up with a reason to say, well, I walked a little bit more slowly because I, well, first of all, they denied that this occurred. Then they were shown a video before and after that they walked more slowly. Then they made it make sense by saying, well, you know, I was a little bit jet-lagged, or I've been having trouble sleeping, or I've been tired. In other words, they would deny then that this happened still, even when they were shown evidence of it. These findings demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure, for the brain to end any dissonance, and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal implication. Even if cause and effect are not right, we want to bring closure. Now, here's another example. As an explorer, Columbus was by all standards at that time an average sailor. But in one area, he was a genius. People believed in him. He projected a sense of confidence that was completely out of proportion to his means. It was a quiet and calm self-assurance. In fact, it was the same confidence usually shown by the nobility themselves. The powerful in the old-style aristocracies felt no need to prove or assert or sell themselves. Being noble, they knew that they always deserved more and asked for it. Columbus got full funding from the Queen of England to sail not one but three ships on the basis of an idea. And at that time, it was really a goofy idea. It was an eyebrow raiser and an eyeball roller combined. To find a new world? Yeah, right. But Columbus taught others how to respond to him by believing in himself, by his confidence. So the most important person to convince about your professional fee is yourself. When you value your services, others will too. Remember, it's up to you to set your own price. Ask for less, and that's exactly what you'll get. Ask for more, and you send a signal that you're worth it. So let's look now, before we wrap up, at the mind matters and brain business of a money story. What's the role of mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The answer, everything. We struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience and quantum physics and strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operation. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. Some groundbreaking research in psychology, neuroscience, and behavioral economics can teach us how to consciously and strategically direct our money decisions and how to outsmart our brains at times. We can strategically harness the chemistry into wiring our brains to create wealth and success. So, how do our brains work against us in creating money stories? Now, remember, the brain has a mind of its own, and we are at least of two or more minds, the emotional and the logical. some examples. Each part of the brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Here's an example. A company has increased profits 26 quarters in a row, and their projected earnings growth for this quarter is 24 cents a share, which would be a 27th quarter in a row to increase their income, their per quarter earnings. They announce instead earnings of 23 cents a share. Still an earnings growth, but it missed the analyst estimate by one penny. They lose $1.5 billion in market value in 5 minutes. Emotions can corrupt decision-making and cause a focus on the immediate, but those who feel no emotion are not good at making decisions. Making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects them to continue. It's called the anhedonic treadmill, that we get on a treadmill, we earn more, we spend more. It takes more and more to have even the same level of pleasure. David Giffen said, "Anyone who believes money makes you happy doesn't have money." Money is a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate, most likely. If a person's a problem drinker, money will make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone is caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. It's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. So, in summary, just a brief overview of roadmapping a new money story. To recognize authorship, you're writing your money story from assumptions to every choice about earning, spending, and saving. Own your story. Accountability is a prerequisite to change. Assess the plot and storylines, recognize the behaviors, hidden messages, and elusive language of mind and emotion. Decide what to change. Make informed decisions about what story components to keep, to let go, to change, and to enhance. Map changes, goals, and success strategies. Author new experiences. Create the new money story you desire. And finally, program new experiences and identity. Incorporate and sustain the changes by corresponding internal growth, by a transformation of identity. So what thoughts or questions or even first clarifications about anything that we talked about?
I like talking about that because I almost had a new client, and then she said, "Oh, you're expensive." And I was like, "Well, I'm worth it." But I didn't say that to her, but I felt like saying that. And then it's a little frustrating because
the response that I sent back is whenever someone has an opposition or an objection, you never want to engage an objection. And sales professionals have taught us this. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. So if you can convert that objection into a question, it might sound something like, "I agree with you that it is expensive." Perhaps the question is, "Will it be of the value to justify that expense?" Here's what I found, that you will experience an exponential return of your investment in coaching. The average return on investment for times when it's been measured is between 5 and 10-fold. In other words, for every dollar you invest, there'll be an average of $5 to $10 return. Now, my goal is 100-to-1 instead of 5 or 10-to-1. So it is expensive, but consider if you don't do it, what would the cost be then?
I
wouldn't say all this at once. I'm just saying all this.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I would just simply say a sentence or two to a potential client. Does that make sense as a way to address that?
Yeah.
Were
and they can
you experiencing too. Any of that yourself? How were you feeling when you quoted your fee?
Well, I was kind of like nervous to say it the first time.
Okay. Well, see, the client's accurately picking up on that and giving voice to what they're perceiving. That's the subliminal conditioning that, like in the study by Dan Gilbert. That's the subliminal condition. That's the message you put out, and they're simply giving voice to your ambivalence about it. So, grounded and centered. Confidence is a state of mind to get grounded and centered and to state your recommendations and your fee from a position of total confidence, knowing that someone is going to have immense value in working with you.
Right. I have one specific client in general who, just up today, she canceled on me an hour early. This was for a Pilates private class. So I charged her $10 less than the average person because she comes twice a week and she wants, otherwise she made me feel like almost manipulated me into like she won't come. So of course I gave in to her. It was like years ago, but now I've set this routine and it's hard to change it now. And then she said, I'm all mad because I have to cancel today because of the dentist. And I was thinking, well, it's not really my fault. I had to hire a babysitter. And she said, well, I'll pay for your babysitter. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, she's trying to manipulate me again. But I allow her to do that to me.
Okay, it's good to recognize that. Think about a model of any other professional. You go to a doc, a dentist, a CPA, a financial professional. You come in and you talk about what you need help with. The professional asks you a few questions, and then the professional makes a recommendation about what would be involved. And here's what my recommendation might sound like. From what you've said, I think you would be an ideal candidate for mentor coaching. I think that what we do in the immediate future can make a major difference in your business or in your life for a long time to come. Here's what I would suggest, that you fill out the client information packet. You can get it on my website. Now, if you don't have a website, you can send it as an attachment in an email, that you fill out the client information packet and get it to me before our first appointment. I'd suggest that we find a standing time for us to meet each week for 50 minutes. And prior to that time, in addition to the client information packet, I'll send you a link for an online payment. My fee is a monthly retainer of whatever you decided your fee is that covers the weekly sessions, whatever communication we have in between times, and whatever material I send you, and make it very simple and very specific. I would recommend that you do a monthly retainer because you don't get into issues like you just described with retainer. Because if you do piecework, somebody's going to begin to look at, well, if you do piecework and you charge each time, then you're going to have a cancellation policy, right? So,
which I did, yeah.
Okay. So if let's say you have a cancellation policy of 24 hours in advance, they don't have to pay. Okay, a client is dealing with something really difficult, a really painful thing. Now,
right.
In addition, if they call you 25 hours in advance, they've just saved 200 and whatever bucks you charge. So you double their resistance, and they're off to the mall and spending that money instead. So
right,
you double their resistance, you've made it complicated. If you charge a monthly retainer that's not divisible by four, because somebody will immediately, if you charge $1,000 a month, somebody will immediately say, oh, man, that's $250. That's a lot of money. Or something that ends in big zeros. You know, a couple of neuroscience studies have shown that that people purchase more or will more likely purchase when something doesn't end in zeros, or there wouldn't be so many things at $9.95 instead of $10.
Yeah.
So those are just some thoughts about how this might apply to professional fees. Is that helpful to think about it that way?
No, yeah, it's very helpful. Because
I think a monthly retainer more reflects the nature of the work we do than piecework.
Or, for sure.
Or charging per session.
I think once I just get one, like, I mean, I'm pretty confident with charging for Pilates because I've been doing it for 20 years. I feel very confident, but since this is a new thing, I guess I just need to get more confident. And just, and if they say no, then that's not the client that I want to.
It's a state of mind, so get grounded and centered and operate from that position and know that the value you bring is going to be lifelong and that you're going to make a major difference for the rest of their lives when they engage with you. Well, we got to stop here. Thank you all very much. Thanks again for a really moving and powerful presentation, Emily. We look forward to picking up with each of you next week.
Perfect.
Bye.
Perfect.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.